It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Happy Saturday, Fairbanks. I'm Randy Zarnke, your host for another episode of Alaska Tracks, a program where we listen to portions of interviews I recorded with veteran outdoorsmen from all over the state. Today's episode will be a little different than normal. In past episodes, we listened to recordings from a single individual. Today, we will hear from two men, Alf Scaffelstead and Bruce Johnstone. Both men were from Southeast, Alf from Hoonah and Bruce from Ketchikan. Both were in their 90s when I recorded them. Let's start with Alf Scaffelstead. He was primarily a commercial fisherman, but also did a lot of hunting and trapping. Alf's stories reach back into the early 1900s. You will notice a distinct Norwegian accent.
I was born in Norway in 1908, and I came to America in 1925. That's down the state of Washington. I came up to Alaska in 1928. So we came up on a little boat, three of us, and with another boat, partner boat. We were going fishing. Well, we didn't know too much about fishing. But anyway, we tried it. We wound up in the cannery. They needed some worker for 2.5 months. So we got on there. That helped out a little bit. And it led to fishing and trapping. The time was not much to speak about those days. Then from then on, we went into the winter. There was no job, nothing. At that time, there was a little better market for mink and otter. So we scratched around, went here and there. We got a few mink and a few otters, and he kept the wolf away from the doors.
Now, you were living here in Hoonah at that time?
At that time, I was in Hoonah. Pretty soon, they got against a national fur. You couldn't even sell them here for a while, the mink and the otter.
When would that have been?
Oh, it went into 30 up to 40.
Why was there no market?
Because the imitation fur took over. Environmentalism was behind it. There was no market. You couldn't afford to go out, to even to pay for the gas. They were pretty tough years. And we gotta have jobs. If you don't have jobs, what do we have? I worked in the woods when I could. There was a logging outfit, Sawmill Reynolds. We worked for them for a couple of winters, but it was just to survive. Really no wages to speak of, but we had a place to sleep anyway. You know, you gotta respect animals too. They have a right to live as well as we have, and they give us part of their living. I don't know what would happen here in the Southeast if we didn't have the deers and the clams and so forth to fall back on when the depression was on.
Where did you develop your outdoor skills? Was that on your own? Did you learn that from other people?
I didn't learn from the other people because there was a few young fellows right here. And we got together, you know, we had to hunt and fish together, mostly hunt together. And they were born here, and they know the terrains, good deers and bad deers, and where we could get them easy, and that's how I picked it up. And then when the kids got big enough, I used the same places to hunt and get the meat, and quite a bit of clams and crabs. Those winters was really severe. We had some real bad winters. It would freeze up along the beach line. It would build up ice from swells water washing up, big tides, it would all freeze up high. Some year winters we had up to 3, 4, 5 feet of snow. And that would pile up 5, 6 feet high. In a lot of places, you couldn't get off of the beach. It was built up so bad, especially when the high tide. One of the things that destroyed a lot of deer some winters, we used to go out and cut down old hemlock right on the beach line, old scrubby hemlock. They have the long gray moss. They can get that, they'll survive.
So you would cut those down in order to help the deer survive?
Oh yeah, many places. Little fawns get out on the beach, they were dead if they around it too long. They could never get back up. When we went and we picked them off the beach, all the deers helped to keep the roads open in the wintertime when you got a lot of snow. They would tramp out on the beach, where maybe in some places where they get more out to the beach, or they nibble on the sweet grass if they can get it. But then when it get cold like that, they couldn't hardly get any of this. They'd freeze up so tight. But we have quite a few deers that way. We're going out to cut the old hemlock down. Not spruce, it's a hemlock. They didn't care for spruce. There were no dead deers around there. They survived good on that.
You mentioned earlier that you found certain places that the deer hunting was better.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember one place that you can describe for us that was your favorite?
Like a Shugwa, with mountain laying up ahead of the bay. It's facing the sun more on both sides. Deers survive a lot better there. They get in a shady place. Very seldom when they get a hard winter that they're going to survive. Most of them will die. There's no way. The water freezes up. They stay there and lick and eat snow, and nose gets full of sores, and mouth gets so full of sore, and they get really bad shape, and pretty soon they die. Mm. I had picked up some of those old bucks in the wintertime. Are you talking about skinny? Some of them died, we couldn't survive them. Some of them, after they got that moss and stuff, it helped them out with a little water, and by God, they came to life. But those little fawns, they were hard to keep from dying. Some of them made it. But those, somehow or another, could survive a winter better than the bucks. The bucks ran themselves down anyway, especially the old buck. They get pretty skinny, even a good winter. I used to look forward to go and help the deer, especially if you got a spring that generally won't freeze. It will be water run down deep in around the rocks. They could lick a little bit. And there we try to break a road, but any of those old hemlock, we cut them down and they'll do fine. That gray moss they like. Someone get about a foot long. They should munch that down. Well, it was one thing we used for to survive was eagles those days. $2 a pair for the eagles. Me and my brother-in-law, Albert Greenwell, and Robert Greenwell, and several other ones, we get together, and the eagles got wise. Albert was a good shot, so he went back on the backside, and I sit out in the front and make kinds of motion and different things to occupy the eagle sitting watching us. And Albert would go out and come back in beside. There was timber on our side, he couldn't come through. So sometimes we sneaked up on him that way, he would get an eagle. But they got pretty wise. When they seen their skiff coming, they took off up on the mountain. But then they closed that out too. No more eagle hunting.
Tell us about the boats you used.
Then we had the rowboat.
Were they made here locally, or where did you get the skiffs from?
Well, almost all local is made in Alaska. Nice rowboats. Dandy rowboat. You could easily make 5, 6, 7 miles an hour. And pretty good sea boats, too. Later on, then we got little gas boats. So we had a little cabin on them. Bad weather, we got on the sit inside anyway, a little stove.
The rowboat, your shoulders must have been real strong.
Well, when you're young, you can take more of that stuff. Rowed all day long. A lot of time from here, clear up in the head of the bay at 13 miles. And one day, and then come back the next day. Sometime you come back the same day. If there was no game, you're trapping and shooting eagles. That's about all we had to do. Now, of course, we had to get wood for home, so you wouldn't face it yet.
But if you were logging during another part of the year, I imagine you could get a bunch of firewood then.
Oh, yeah. No problem to get firewood, but it had to be worked up.
Well, there's a picture on the wall behind you of a real nice fish that you caught a few years ago. Can you tell us about that one?
Well, there isn't much of a history to it.
Did you catch it rod and reel?
No, I got it on a commercial gear. Commercial gear, you can't play them like on a sport gear. So I made a snubbing line. The gear ends, I get hold of the leader, and then I put the snap into my snubbing line, and then you could let them go when they start fighting. Because if they take a run on you, it break a good, strong line. That's one way you can save them on the commercial gear or on the trolling gear like that.
Now, that's a great big fish. Do you estimate how big it was?
No, I don't know. I think probably between 50 and 60 pounds. That's a pretty fish. It has a rainbow color on it. A lot of difference in king salmon. At the same time, when I got that fish, 2 days before, I had a big one up alongside my boat. Ugly, black, long head. The head was sound like a metal ball. And I hit him 4 or 5 times and I thought he was dead. I couldn't use gaff on him. I couldn't left them all my gunwale on the boat. So I was looking for a rope, turn around, and all at once, it took off like a bullet. I had to let go of the line because the line was a small line and it would cut my fingers off. It went and it poofed when the line hooked up on the railing. It was nothing to it, he was gone. That was probably a foot longer than this one, but a different king salmon. It's an ugly looking thing. I had him right alongside the boat. That's happened several times, and get a hold of one of them big ones.
Those are some great stories from a man who lived an active outdoor lifestyle. I'm not sure I could have kept up with Alf even when he was in his 90s. Let's take a short break here for a word from our sponsors. Now for the second half of today's show. Our guest this time is Bruce Johnstone of Ketchikan. Bruce has some stories that simply amaze me. I hope you enjoy listening to him.
I made a living for 7 people to fell on when I was 10 years old. But Smithsonian was paying $45 a piece for black bear skulls and $75 for grizzlies. So if I could get one bear a month, those days was pretty good money. When I first started guiding, I was guiding the guides. People that wanted to get licenses.
And that was here in the Ketchikan area?
Well, most of my bear hunting was up around Admiralty and Chichagof and Baranoff Island.
How many years did you do that?
Close to 40 years.
How many hunters would you take out every year?
About 3 trips a year, but most of my hunts were big hunts, 30-day hunts. The Mellon family from Pittsburgh, they used to come up every 5 years and for a spring hunt and a fall hunt.
Now that's the very wealthy Mellon family?
At that time, they were the wealthiest family in the United States. The Campbell Church Jr. used to have a bunch of boats up here every year, and I was always guided for him. I never did outfit anything for myself.
So you hunted off of the boats then? That's where people stayed?
But they were always 6 or 8, maybe 10 hunters at a time. Arnie Israelson, it lives in, I think, in Haines now. And I used to do a lot of guiding together.
Did you take any very big bears?
I got one monster and up in Kootenai Bay. I didn't get one of my hunters.
Do you remember any other stories when the Mellons were here?
I arrested a Mellon once. I took him in the junior because he had to shoot an extra bear. They allowed 2, but one shot distance, he had to kill him. So the skipper of the boat and I, we got together and took him up to Homer Jewell, who was the game warden here. We get down to the commissioner. He got a big kick out of it.
How about deer hunting? I assume that you did a lot of deer hunting?
Oh yeah, back in the early days, we just depended on deer meat for a living. My worst scare I ever had when I was trapping was in the winter of 1922-23. I was trapping at the head of Rudyard Bay then, over on the mainland. Back in those days, we didn't have game laws like we do nowadays. So we could start trapping whenever we thought that was prime. All I had for the gun those days was a single-shot shotgun, 12-gauge, with a broken extract. So I had a piece of lead that would just fit down the barrel, and I'd drop it down to knock shells out. That one day I'd come in, and I hadn't shot the gun, and I didn't want to drop the lead through while unloaded in there, so I left the gun in the skill. The next day I went out and it had rained hard and the barrel was half full of water and I poured it out, but I thought then if I seen a duck or anything I could use for bait, I would fire and put in the new shell. I didn't see anything and I forgot about it and went into the woods to look at my sets. I'd sat the day before. I walked up almost to the set. It was a little hard to find, but I walked up close to it and there was a cub bear in the trap. And I was wondering what to do with it, and I heard a noise behind me, and the mother was coming up behind me. And I thought about the old gun, whether it would fire or not. I didn't start to grow until I was putting her 16 years old. I was putting a rump to that, weighing maybe 65 or 70 pounds. And even standing up with shooting a 12-gauge, I would take a few steps backwards. I knew I only had one shot, maybe. So I got down on my knees so I'd be pretty well level with the bear and expecting it to rear up. But it didn't. It walked right in almost to the end of the gun. And I pulled the trigger, and as a rule, you won't hear the hammer go down. But the hammer went down, click, then it fired. The bear was dead then. The extra noise scared the cub, and it pulled out of the trap and went up a tree then. And I shot him, but that was the scariest thing I've ever had.
Can you still get out now and do that sort of thing?
No, my legs are just about gone. I tangled with a bear that was in 58. They chewed me up on this hip too bad. It took, had to put in a new one, and then when they put in a new one, that made it about an inch shorter than the other one, so I had to go back and have the leveled up again.
And what were the circumstances of the bear attack?
I don't know. But I think what it was, that year there was very few berries and very few fish. That was on the Yolink River. Two fellows and I went up moose hunting. And we went up about 2 days before the season to make a camp. And we went out trout fishing. And the next day we went back to get some more trout. And where we gutted the bear had licked the blood off of the rocks there. The next day I went out to get some ducks for camp meat. And I had a shotgun then, an Ithaca lightweight. That was in the fall time, but in that spring, I had a hunt out, and the fellow brought his own little hand-strap, the clay pigeons. He was trying to learn how to shoot a shotgun. And he brought a bunch of shells that was made up in Canada. They had little smoke pellets so that you could follow your shot. And not one of them would fire in my gun. I'm not really a duck hunter, but I had 3 or 4 shells in a pant pocket and my marble matchbox down in there. And I was being legal, I had 3 shells in the gun. And I seen these 3 bear ahead of me about 200 yards. And I made a lot of noise, I didn't want no bear. But they came up through scattered willows. There were 3 of them together, a great big boar, a female, and a 2-year-old. And I seen they meant business, so I thought I would take the biggest one first. Did you ever see a bear charge anybody?
Yep.
Was the only one that ever stood up. He come on my head to one side. They don't want to bite you, but they feel like they have to. And I was going to shoot under the ear. And just as I pulled the trigger, the female hit me, and he went down and didn't kill him, but he was making a lot of noise. And the female then stood up. She was about that much higher than I was. And I just stuck the gun up under the chin, that white spot, pulled click. He came down on me and picked me up and shook me, and everything tore out, and I went out into the river. It's a glacier stream with real muddy. She went and shoot on the big one, and pretty soon she came down over the bank at me, and I was pulling around that water, and I was trying to feel for the shotgun. She knocked me down and started biting on me again, and it bit her again up there, the big one, and she went back and they bit it again. And by that time I had the gun up, full of water. I just as soon get blown up as eat up. So she came over the back and I pulled the trigger and that one fired. And water and all went through that barrel. I had to get a little bit back of the ear. By that time the little fellow got into it. I had one shell left. And I could hear a boat coming. The guide up there, he had 3 hunters. The guide was an old-time guide here in town, Dale Richardson. He was one of our good guides. He had run the boat to where I was, and the cub and I was rolling around fighting. And he shot 2 times, missed either one of us, and the next shot hit the bear in the foot, and that made him have his ear. And then he shot, he killed the bear. They took me out to where their boat was anchored. One of the fellows of me, he was going to do the docking. They rolled me over on the floor and pulled my pants off and going to dock my leg. And the skipper of the boat was a 70-year-old, and he wouldn't allow a booze aboard. And the fellow was going to do the docking and said, now if we only had a bottle of whiskey, we could pour that in these holes and stop the infection. Skipper said, well, there's no booze on my boat. And one of the guys, well, he says, I smuggled some aboard. Anyway, he brought up the bottle and coffee mug, and he poured it up almost half full, and he handed it to Pete Bringsley, who was going to do the doctor. And instead of giving it to me, he drank it himself. But then he just poured the rest of that whiskey in those holes. And oh, that ever hurt. But I think it done the business, because they never had any infection at all.
Why do you think the bears attacked?
I think they were starving to death. One of our local, Daniel Eichner, had a helicopter service there. He flew over, that was a couple of days later, and seen 2 bears fighting. And when he went back, one of them was eating the other one. They were starving to death that year.
So then you eventually went to the hospital and had the hip replaced?
It was about 3 years later.
And was that here in town, or?
No, I went to Phoenix, Arizona. When the legs started giving me trouble, at that time, we had here in Alaska, it's supposed to be one of the best orthopedic surgeons on the coast, lived in Sitka. I went up to see him, and he said there was nothing he could do about it. I just have to live with it. That fall, I was up guiding on the Yonah River, fishing guide, and some fishermen came up, and one of them was the doctor. He started asking me about my age and how old my father was when he passed away and my mother, and he says, well, you can live quite a few more years yet. And he says, I've got a friend in the Phoenix that's a good orthopedic surgeon, and he says, when I go back, I'll talk to him, and if he thinks he can help you, I'll come back and get you. So I thought, well, I'll just talk. A week later, here you can. He says, it's a catch to it. You're going to have to take me fishing 2 days before I take you down. He got down there, and this fellow, Joseph DuPont, what he done. Wasn't legal in the United States. We had the hinges and everything, but we didn't have the kind of cement that would hold them in place. A fellow named Charnley, an Englishman, had come up with this type. DuPont had went to England and studied under this Englishman. When he came back, he brought some of this goop with him.
So you were the first person he used it on?
Yeah. And of course, it wasn't legal. And on the way back, the nurse put me on the plane in Phoenix. And the guy changed planes in Seattle. Whatever the metal was, set off all the... They wouldn't let me on the plane. I didn't know what was happening either, but finally, one of the girls said, aren't you the fellow that had the hips worked on? I said, yeah, maybe that's it. So they finally let me come on.
That brings us to the end of today's program. I hope you enjoyed hearing from both Alf Skaffelstad and Bruce Johnstone. Those of us who love the outdoors can aspire to the life that these two men lived on a daily basis. Tune in again next week when we'll hear more stories from another old-timer.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.